Little theme music from the television show Beretta to get us going on this segment of our program here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking about police detectives and what they do during and after a crime is reported. Craig Bray is our guest. He's a detective at the Green Bay Police Department. Detective Bray has worked at the city of Green Bay since 2013. He's done police work for more than 20 years. And we'll talk with him today about how, maybe a little bit about how he became a detective. And you'll hear how police investigate missing persons cases. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions about police detective work. Let us know what you wonder about how detectives investigate crimes. Or maybe you're a police officer. What do you wish fellow community members knew about the work that you do? I hope you'll give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Detective Craig Bray with us by phone today. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining in.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, I think a lot of people enjoy fictional stories about crime, but when you see crime and police work on TV, how accurate is it in your mind?
Well, like some of the, I guess, the cases that they would profile on TV are be similar to the type of cases we handle in real life. The biggest difference is the time period. You know, we have this thing called the CSI effect, where you know, the police on TV investigate crime and they get DNA results and results immediately. When we know that oftentimes these types of things take months, if not years, for us to get back on a lot of the forensics. So.
Yeah. So given that, what's your day-to-day job look like?
I'm in the sensitive crime division. So we investigate physical and sexual abuse. And then we also help out on any major crimes that occur in the city, like a homicide. And we also work on missing persons. But from day to day, the office, the district attorney's office in Brown County, we work with community partners because we have a multidisciplinary team as part of the sensitive crime, which is comprised of Child Protective Services, Willow Tree, which is our child advocate, and then the sexual assault center in the office. So when we get which we get several cases a week, I'll start working with our community partners to figure out the best approach to work on.
We are having a few voice problems. So actually, you're sounding fine, but you're breaking up a little bit. So we're going to try and set up another setup for you, maybe on a Google Meet or something, Greg. But just so you know that we're setting that up, and we'll probably be moving to that in just a minute. In the meantime, if you have questions for Detective Craig Bray, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. What inspired you, Craig, to become a police officer?
I've wanted to be a police since I was old. My uncle was
Oh, you know what? We're breaking up. So I'll tell you what, we're going to take a little break, and we're going to get you on a Google Meet, and then we'll be back. And again, you can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and our guest today that we're talking with is Craig Bray. Craig is a detective at the Green Bay Police Department, and because of the show that we had just preceding this, the segment, Hannah Morrissey's book, When I'm Dead, involved detective work. We thought it'd be interesting to carry that further and look at a real live detective and what the real live detectives have to do. And we have Craig Bray on. I think we have him on by a Google Meet right now. Craig, are you there? Having a little trouble hearing you there, Craig. So we're having a little bit of difficulty here. We'll get that straightened out in just a second or two. In the meantime, just a reminder: Garden Talk tomorrow from 11 to 1. We've got a couple of different things to talk about. We're going to be talking about. I'm not sure what we're talking about because the information. Oh, we're talking about earth-friendly gardens and woody ornamentals, if I'm not mistaken, as well on tomorrow's show. Well, let's see if we got Craig with us now. Craig, you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Thank you so much. I had asked you what, you know, and maybe you can go back to this. What's your day-to-day life like on the job?
So my day-to-day work experience is I work in sensitive crimes in the Green Bay Police Department. There's three detectives in the sensitive crimes, and we investigate all child deaths, physical and sexual abuse of children, major sexual assaults of adults, and any other major crime that might come out, including up to homicide. So we work with community partners like Child Protective Services, the Child Advocacy Center, which is Willow Tree, and the Sexual Assault Center in the Brown County DA's office to investigate these cases. And so when we come in at the beginning of our shift, we'll have cases assigned to us, and then we start working with our community partners to investigate this the best possible.
Yeah, I want to ask you about becoming a detective, because I think that there's got to be a process involved with that. How'd you end up becoming a detective?
Well, I started my law enforcement career in January of 1999. I worked for a couple of smaller agencies. And you always have to start out in patrol with every agency. You work patrol, you do specialty stuff. And the more experience you get on patrol, and especially things like maybe like a SWAT team or a CCIT, which would be like a crisis intervention team, a drug unit, all that stuff, you develop your skills and your ability to do the job as a eventually as a detective, which would encompass all that stuff in your career. And after several years of, you know, working as a patrol officer, I eventually took the detective test and fortunately was able to pass it, and became a detective in 2019 at the Green Bay Police Department.
It's by the time you're a detective, you've done pretty much everything when it comes to police work before you get there, from the sound of it.
Yeah, the more specialty units, the more patrol time you have is definitely going to make you a better candidate to be a detective, because when you're a detective, you're expected to know how all the ins and outs of every department and every specialty unit work.
Yeah. What kind of tips, I guess we should say, should you have, would can you give folks for working with a police officer or a detective, after, let's say you've called 911 to report a crime, what are the tips for working with a police officer?
So I guess my best advice for working with a police officer is whoever calls and is requesting assistance from the police, they kind of set the tone. They kind of determine how things are going to go. Obviously, people call the police because situations have gotten out of control or they don't know what to do as far as they need help. And the police officer's there to give them advice, help them take their report, whatever it may be. But I guess the best advice I can give is when you report a crime or you need help, make sure that you communicate well with the officer and that you tell them everything that has happened, whether you think it's important or not important for the case. And then always just communicate with the officer as best as possible so that as additional information comes in, it can be relayed to the police officer.
Yeah, and I'm sure it all varies by circumstances. Is there a priority? Do you guys have a priority of which calls to respond to first? Or
so when patrol gets dispatched, it goes through the Brown County Dispatch Center, and they do prioritize calls, of course. Here in Green Bay, we are very busy. Our patrol officers take a lot of calls. I want to say they average between 80 and 90,000 calls a year for service. So it does get prioritized, and unfortunately, some of the, I guess, lower priority calls, which would be like maybe like a minor theft or something, is going to take... is not going to be priority compared to like something that's immediately occurring, like some sort of physical assault or an accident in traffic or something like that.
Yeah. I'm thinking about various circumstances as the person who's going to make the call or, you know, ask for help. And I'm thinking about, all right, grandpa's missing, or an adult, let's just say an adult shows up missing. I mean, when do you report something like that? How long do you wait to report something like that?
Well, it's not like you see on TV. We would expect someone to report immediately. I mean, people know their families the best, and if something doesn't seem right and someone's missing, we would expect them to report that immediately, because the sooner we can get the information and we can start notifying officers to look for, you know, the said missing person, is, you know, the quicker that we're going to be able to come to a resolution with the case.
So do it. Yeah. Don't wait around. And obviously the same would hold true if a child is missing. I think that almost would go without saying.
Correct.
And after you report a person is missing, you guys are on it pretty quickly, typically.
Yeah, we, like I said, when a person is reported as missing, we start the investigation immediately. We try to determine the severity. You know, does this person have medical needs? What is their age? Is this something that's happened in the past? And other risk factors, you know, whether they're drug dependent, stuff like that. We want to know right away.
It makes a lot of sense to me. So what are strategies you might use, or other police detectives might use, in locating a missing person?
So we rely heavily on the family and friends to let us know like patterns of the missing person, where they might frequent, social media apps, try to figure out who they're communicating with. And then to immediately get patrol out, checking areas, and just notifying, I guess, the public as to what we're looking for, because the public does like to help in these situations, and we rely heavily on the publication to locate missing people.
And then what happens after you find a previously missing person? What happens then?
So fortunately, we have a lot of resources in Green Bay. So we, you know, determine why someone went missing, if they were convinced to go with someone, or if they're depressed, or if they just wanted to get away and didn't want to be bothered. You know, all those things we take into factor, and then we determine what the best outcome is by, you know, offering them resources. If they need to go to the crisis center, if they need to go to the hospital, or if they just want to go back with family, or if they're fine and there's no, I guess, danger, we can just note that they're in good health and they just don't want to be bothered.
Yeah. Okay. It makes sense. To me, for sure. Conrad called, couldn't stay with us. Is there a way that police can tell if someone is hearing impaired or deaf?
That's a good question. And that there we would rely back on the family, or close friend, to notify us of any like medical needs that the person may need. If that was the case, we do have resources to help us communicate with hearing impaired people.
Our guest today, Craig Bray, detective at the Green Bay Police Department, and we're talking with him about detective work. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Let's talk about forensics for a minute, because forensics is always, it almost amuses me, and I don't know anything about being a detective, but it kind of amuses me when I see a NCIS show or the FBI show, because they're really quick at getting that information that is almost unbelievably fast. How do you use science to help you evaluate a crime scene?
So we have a forensics unit that's comprised of three civilians. So when we get a major scene and it needs to be processed, we usually call in our forensic unit, and they will start taking swabs of various areas that we find, like whether it be blood or touch DNA, and we determine what needs to be sent to a crime lab. And we work with, for DNA, we work with the state crime lab out of Madison. So what we can do is if we don't have a suspect, but we have a belief that this is the blood from the suspect or touch DNA or a hair, we can send that information or those swabs to the crime lab, and they can develop what's called an unknown DNA profile. So once we get that profile developed, then we can try to develop a suspect. If we do develop a suspect, we can get what's called a standard buccal swab, which is a swab of the inner cheek of the suspect. That's a controlled DNA swab, and we send that to the lab for comparison. And then they'll determine if this unknown DNA profile from the crime scene matches the suspect. And that's one of the things that we use a lot and on a lot of our crime scenes, and we've had really good success with DNA hits. Another thing that they can do with DNA is if someone is also a convicted felon and their DNA is in CODIS, and if the crime is serious enough, they will put that DNA profile in the CODIS, and they will run that profile against all the profiles that are already in CODIS to see if we get a match. If we do get a match, then we would have to go and get that controlled sample from that suspect at that time.
And if it is a match, I mean, is it legally okay for you to go and get the swab from somebody? Could somebody say, well, no, I'm not going to let you do that. That's my personal cheek that you want to swab.
Yep. That's a good question. So DNA doesn't change in a person. So there's no, when we seize property or someone's DNA, like there's got to be a circumstance that could be destroyed. Well, someone cannot destroy their DNA. So we would have to then go write a warrant to seize that. We would write what we call as a buccal standard warrant. And then we have it reviewed by a court commissioner or a judge. And if they feel there's enough probable cause to issue that warrant, they will issue it, and then we would serve that person with the warrant and obtain the buccal swab at that time. Otherwise, people can consent to it and just give us their DNA.
So there is a fair amount of really good technology that you probably didn't have, or you might not have had when you first started as a police officer 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's correct. The DNA has developed a lot since 1999, and then we also deal with obviously a lot of electronic stuff that we didn't deal with, back in the early 2000s or late 1990s, between social media apps, text messages, cell phone calls. That's another part of forensics that we get a lot of information and helps us in the investigations.
John emailed and wants to know, what do you look for when you're investigating a crime scene? You know, what are the most common clues that suggest suspects might leave at a crime scene?
Well, it could be anything from, like the DNA to sometimes people drop their personal property on a crime scene. There are so many cameras out there now. We will do a neighborhood canvas looking for any ring cameras, blink cameras, home security camera systems, and then just good witnesses. Talk to witnesses and then try and determine how the crime occurred. In a sense, reenact the crime a little bit. So it's a totality of a lot of different things that we initially look for. And we rely heavily on, the initial caller as to what information they provide us.
As I was thinking about the show today, I thought back, it's been a few years now, but there was two parents who were murdered, and the 13 or 14 year old daughter was taken. And in months went by, many, many, many months, and then the girl was actually able to escape from the person that had done it. But thinking about it, it was almost like a whim. The guy had happened to be driving by and saw the girl, and so he comes and doesn't live in the area. There's no connection to the people at all, and he just kills the mother and dad and takes the daughter. And I was thinking about that from a detective's standpoint, because police are certainly going to be looking for connections, and sometimes there aren't any.
Yeah, those are for sure the toughest cases. When you have someone who doesn't use any sort of electronic social media, you have no video surveillance, you have no witnesses. You may have a suspect that has never committed a crime before, so you would not have any sort of fingerprints or DNA on file. So those cases are extremely tough, and that's sometimes a case like that will turn into a cold case.
Yeah, and I imagine you've had some experience with that, and it's probably not the ones you enjoy the most, for sure.
No, cold cases are extremely tough. Because you're trying to investigate something that happened years back, and things were obviously done different back in the 80s, 70s, or 90s, So you just got to kind of start from, step one and start working the case all over again.
Yeah, it's got to be tough. You are in the sensitive crimes unit. You're a sensitive crimes detective. Then someone else wonders, what does that all entail?
So we're part of a multidisciplinary team, it's called, here in Brown County, which is comprised of the three sensitive crimes detectives for the Green Bay Police Department, Child Protective Services of Brown County, the Willow Tree Child Advocacy Center, and the Family Services Sexual Assault Center. So when we get a crime against a child, some sort of abuse, whether it be physical or sexual, the first thing we do is obviously an officer will take an initial report, and then we set up what's called a forensic interview. And a forensic interview is done we have two forensic interviewers here in Brown County at the Willow Tree Child Advocacy Center, and they're very, very good at their job. And their job, I mean, they have other tasks, but their main purpose is to talk to children. They're not associated with the Brown County Sheriff, or I'm sorry, Brown County DA's office or the Green Bay Police Department. They have no, they don't do any of the investigation. They simply talk to the child, ask non-leading questions, and then myself, Child Protective Services, and maybe a prosecutor will watch the interview of the child. And children can be interviewed for other things too, like witness to a crime. So after the interview is completed, if a child discloses that a crime occurred to that child, then we start the investigation as far as talking to witnesses, talking to the suspect. And then if we determine that there's probable cause, we can either make an arrest and or refer charges over to the Brown County District Attorney's Office. And that whole time, we utilize the Sexual Assault Center to have an advocate there to help them with services, the victim with services.
Detective Craig Bray, our guest today of the Green Bay Police Department, as we talk about what he does and what other detectives do under crime situations. I'd love to hear from you. You can call us at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. You are also involved with officer training. How has officer training evolved over the years in terms of methods?
So, yeah, when I worked patrol, I was a field training officer. And it's probably one of the most important jobs because we need good police officers out there and we need good, hardworking police officers. So when I was a field training officer, I took that position very serious. We would basically, there's like four phases of training with the Green Bay Police Department. You start at like phase one and you start taking minor calls for service, maybe like a 911 hangup, a simple theft with, you know, suspect. And then depending on how the officer does, and every officer starting out is different. We get some from other agencies that have a lot of experience where this may be the officer's very first job ever. So it depends on how fast they, you know, I guess start to understand the job. And then we evaluate every day how they interact with people, if they are obtaining the correct information, if they're writing good police reports. And then as they get more confident and develop their skills, they will advance to the next step. And each step can take anywhere from like 4 to 6 weeks, if not longer. Fortunately for the Green Bay Police Department, we're busy, so they get a lot of reps. Where some of the smaller agencies, which I've worked for smaller agencies, you don't get as many calls, so it takes a little bit longer to get used to what you need for what information you need per call that you go on.
So there's a lot of calls.
We do have a lot of calls. And when you're in the field training program, you're not stuck to like a sector of the city. So like you can jump any call that comes out. Like if it's a retail theft at a store and you want to work on retail thefts, we can sometimes have 2-3 of those calls going on at one time. So our field training officer would take the officer that they're training on that call, and they would work on making sure they obtain that information. It's not a high pressure call. It's usually the situation's over with, and it's just a matter of getting the information and then trying to track down the suspect after the fact.
Yeah. And to kind of go along with that, somebody else was wondering, how do you talk with victims who you've got an adult who's, has been under something has happened to them there, but they're under a lot of stress. Maybe they're traumatized adults. How do you talk with victims like that who are under that kind of stress?
Well, I mean, when it comes to the children, that's why we use the advocacy center. So they only have to tell their story one time if they want to. But when it comes to adults, you know, it just comes down to being empathetic, understanding that people are when we deal with people, a lot of times it's the worst day of their life. And we have to kind of be a calming and reassuring voice and let them know that we're going to do whatever we can to help them. So it just comes down to having good people skills, understanding people, and making sure that you are empathetic to their situation.
Yeah, and along the same line, you must have to sometimes answer, or maybe you used to have, maybe not as much now. You've got really sensitive situations. How are you able to de-escalate really sensitive situations, maybe involving a couple of people?
So when we get to a scene or we're dealing with a situation where it's obviously a very sensitive situation, we want to, a lot of times if people will move together, they'll amp each other up, we'll maybe separate them, talk in a calm voice, let them know we understand their frustrations and their concerns, and that we're going to get through this, but we need everyone to calm down so we can communicate. And then it's also just kind of being straightforward with people, letting them know what you're going to do to help them and how you're going to help them and giving them options. One thing I've learned in this job is if you just tell people, well, there's nothing I can do for you, well, that's not an answer anyone wants to hear.
No.
You got to give people options. Like, hey, these are what your options are as a victim or, whatever, to these crimes.
And so then they've got some choice. So then they're looking at, okay, here are my choices. So I can, you give them a way to think that through, basically.
Yeah. And when we are in these situations that are heated at the time, we don't expect people to make rash decisions at that time. We can provide our card with the report number and say, hey, can you take some time, think about this, talk with family, friends, and then come back to us and let us know what you want to do. If it's press charges, if it's not press charges, there's all kinds of things, but we've gotten to an age in law enforcement where we got to be much more understanding of people's situations, and that when they are upset, making those decisions at that time is not the best time to just say, okay, well, they said they didn't want to press charges, or they said they want to press charges. Let's give them some time to think about it, and then call us back. We're not going anywhere. We're always around.
Okay. In the book, When I'm Dead, we interviewed the author, Hannah Morrissey, before that and before this interview. And she had talked with, and used in her book, she had talked with a detective who told her, everybody lies sometimes. And people have, the author was talking about how some people have tells or ways others can tell that they're lying. How much of that do you see in your work?
Well, unfortunately, people do lie to the police all the time. I would have to say that's a pretty true statement by the other detective. When we talk to people, we understand that immediately if they're probably not telling us everything or the truth. And that's why we got to build that rapport with them and get them to trust us. And my best practice through the years is just be honest with people. And if you're honest with them and let them know exactly what you're thinking and where you're going with certain things, obviously without jeopardizing any sort of an investigation, they tend to be more honest and tell you more details. But even victims of crimes, unfortunately, lie to us because they might feel that they caused the situation or amped the situation up. But in the end, if we just have the truth, we can usually work through any problem. And that goes to, making sure that we have a good communication so that we're not finding out other information after the fact, and then it discredits the person we talked to.
Yeah. Do you, as a detective, have to appear in court to, when there's, some trial or something? And what do you, how does that go for you? Or what do you have to be prepared for under circumstances like that if you do it?
Yeah, that's a good question. So when we get assigned a case, we're tasked with being the, like, we are the keeper of that case and we are in charge of everything that goes on in with the case. So a major investigation, we will typically be the first person subpoenaed for, let's say, a preliminary hearing on that case. So that would be the initial hearing to determine if there was probable cause for the district attorney's office to go to trial on the case. So we would be subpoenaed for that. And this might be getting a little too in depth, but in a preliminary hearing, we can testify to hearsay from other officers. So we would be able to testify to other officers' reports. And that, like I said, that just establishes probable cause, which is like 51% more likely that something happened than did not happen. And then if it goes to a trial, a lot of times we'll sit what they call second chair next to the prosecutor. So as the prosecutor is arguing the case in court and maybe in front of a judge or in front of a jury, we would be there to make sure they're not missing anything because we know the case, the ins and outs of the case totally. So court happens a lot. I would say I average anywhere from 5 to 20 subpoenas on my desk at any one time. So that can be very time consuming and it can be tough because some of these cases are old that we get subpoenaed for too. They can be 2, 3, even up to, I have one trial coming up that's 5 years old. So try to remember that is tough.
Oh, and that is must also mean that you have to go back. Let's talk about the records you have to keep and then going back and reviewing those records before you're asked.
Yeah, and that's why we memorialize all this with good details. And that was when I talked earlier, making sure officers take good details. And now we're in the day of body cameras, which are definitely help us because we can go back and review these body camera footage to help us, remind us what the person looked like, show us the setting, the weather that day. All that stuff helps us remember it, but writing a good detailed report definitely helps when you go to court.
Our guest, Craig Bray, Detective Craig Bray, works at the Green Bay Police Department, a busy guy, and I know there are questions for you, Craig, so we'll get to that. If you want to join in, the number to call 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking what goes on in the life of a detective. Detective work, and Craig Bray is a detective at the Green Bay Police Department. If you have questions for him about procedure or maybe something along those lines or an experience, I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you can email to talk@wpr.org. Do officers like the body cameras or do they think they're too invasive?
No, they like the body cameras because it shows, how people sometimes act and officers are, do they make mistakes sometimes? Of course, but 99.9% of the time, the officers are doing the right thing and they're just trying to help and they're just trying to do their job and they're put in very difficult situations and the body cam supports that every time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You've received several awards for your work over the years. You got an award for helping the FBI with an investigation in Detroit. What was going on with that case? Or can you talk about it?
Yeah, I can talk about it. It's a closed case. It was a gentleman. This was back when I was working in the UP of Michigan, Upper Peninsula of Michigan, a small agency called Kingsford Public Safety. We had a gentleman that was from Kingsford that purchased all the materials to make a bomb at a hardware store in Iron Mountain. And he put the bomb together in Kingsford, and then he drove it to the federal building in Detroit and placed the bomb. Obviously, I don't know everything that happened down there, but the bomb sat in the building for a few days before anyone noticed it because it was in like a work bag, and they were doing construction on the building at the time. So when they figured out who had made the bomb, I was tasked with doing surveillance on the gentleman. And I had a rapport with him from working in Kingsford for several years. And my job was to just kind of make contact with him. Just like if he would be out mowing his grass or whatever, I would just go make contact so that the investigating agency, which was the Secret Service, was able to identify him. Because in a small town like Kingsford, you can't ride around with a bunch of blacked out SUVs. Raise a lot of attention to yourself. So they just utilized us in that we were able to communicate with this gentleman and let them know, yep, it's the guy you're looking for. It's a, you know. And then when we went to do the arrest, I just knocked on the door and it was a very low key arrest because this gentleman had no fear of the local police because he worked with us all the time.
Yeah. That makes sense. It's interesting. And you got the Packer Protect and Serve Award. Well, tell us that story. That's pretty cool.
That's an interesting story. It was about a child who was kidnapped by his father and was missing for about 5 years. We had exhausted a lot of resources, and I was assigned the case. I don't remember when. I want to say in 2020. And it took us about 6 to 8 months working with the U.S. Marshals, and we were able to locate the child in a vehicle in Austin, Texas, not Austin, Arlington, Texas area, and reunite that child with his mother after 5 years. So that was a good experience. Unfortunately, the child had never been to like a hospital, a doctor, school in that time that the child was missing. So we were able to get the child home with mom so that the child can, you know, get the medical needs the child needed and to start the education process.
Very, very great to hear that. Ben called, couldn't stay with us. And by the way, we've had, Craig, I'll let you know, we've had a lot of calls, but we've been having some phone issues, so we've been losing people. It's like we were losing you a little bit at the beginning of the show. Ben got through, couldn't stay with us, though. How true is it that officers are allowed to lie to members of the public when they're interrogating them?
So that is a true thing. There is no crime against lying, the police lying to a suspect or a witness or whatever it may be. It's not the best practice, but it is a tool sometimes used to try and elicit information that we know someone's withholding from the police.
And how often do you have to interrogate people? TV shows make it seem very intense, and this emailer is wondering how accurate is that?
That's not accurate at all. Interviews are very low key. They're very, they're not like you see on TV. We bring someone into an interview room. Obviously, if they're in custody, we have to read them their rights. If they're not in custody, we explain to them that you're not under arrest. You can leave at any time. You do not have to be here. And then we just start talking about the case. Sometimes the suspect or the person we're talking to get upset. That does happen because we ask tough questions. We have to ask the tough questions in order to, you know, figure out or try and solve the crime that we're investigating.
And to go along with that, you often see, and even the people being interrogated will say, oh, this is a good cop, bad cop kind of interview, huh? Do you use that technique ever?
I wouldn't say we use a good cop, bad cop technique, but we do find that certain suspects relate better with other detectives. Say some suspects like talking to, say, a female detective. So we'll utilize a female detective to talk with that individual. Some people might have had a bad experience with that detective in the past and don't want to talk with them. So we'll utilize a different detective to talk with them. So I guess that would be the extent of good cop, bad cop, but it's not like you see on TV. It's more along the lines of like this personality fits this situation a little bit better.
Yeah. The Green Bay Police Department has something called community policing. Can you talk a bit more about that program?
Yeah, that's a very, very popular program with our department and the community. So they get assigned like districts, like Adam District, Bravo District, Charlie, or David. And I don't know, I think there's two or three community police officers for each district. And they work with like landlords and businesses on just like nuisance problems. And they really get to know their community, which also helps when we get like a major crime in that area. They seem to know everybody in the neighborhood, all the businesses, and they work well with getting us some, you know, information as to who lives where, or if we need camera footage from a certain business, they have all the contacts for that. If there's landlord-tenant disputes, and it really helps clean up stuff for patrol so that they can focus on the more 911 immediate type calls.
The work you have to do, and you, as you've described it, sometimes it's got to be hard to take sometimes if there's abuse of a child or something like that. How do you keep that from your personal life?
Yeah, I mean, we do see a lot of traumatic events as law enforcement officers. The main thing you got to do is, you know, understand that you're doing the job for the right reasons. You're trying to help people who are at the lowest point in their lives, which should make you feel good internally. But outside of that, you want to surround yourself with positive people away from work. Hopefully your coworkers are positive and you can work well with them. And then when you aren't at work, you have a positive influence, like with your family and stuff. So you can kind of step away from the job a little bit. But if you're doing the right things, you should feel good about your job, and understanding that we deal with people at the worst times, and it is just part of the job, but we have to just make sure that you surround yourself with good people, and it kind of all works itself out.
Do you involve yourself in the community itself, maybe even as a way to unwind, but aside from the work itself as a detective, do you get yourself involved in some ways?
I would say like once in a while we do. Like I've done a couple of events now at UWGB, University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, question and answers. They're starting up a law enforcement program. I think we're going to be bowling here coming up one of these days with the new community shelter. So we do occasional, community events. A little bit. We do that a little bit, and there's always something going on, but we have a large department and officers are always getting involved in the community.
Yeah, I would think that would be the case. Well, I tell you what, it's been a pleasure talking with you today, Craig, and it sounds like you're going to be in that job for a long, long time.
Well, I definitely have probably another 10 years to go before I can retire. But, I enjoy it. I don't want to wish away my career because I enjoy what I do.
Well, it's been great talking with you, and I really appreciate it. It sounds like Green Bay's got a good police department there, and I appreciate the work that you've done, and I hope we'll have a chance to talk again. Thanks, Craig.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Detective Craig Bray with the Green Bay Police Department. It was great to have him with us today to talk about the work that they do. And I'm sorry for the phone problems that we were having, as I know a lot of people wanted to talk and we're just not able to get in. So sorry for that. And the next time we do something like this, we'll make sure that everything's working fine. Our team works pretty fine all the time, every day. Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud are producers for the shows. Technical directors, Jeff Robbins with me today. Lee Rayburn was with me a couple times this week as well. Our executive producer, of course, is Jill Nadeau. And you'll be hearing from Jill tomorrow, as a matter of fact, on Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.